from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tensions are up in the South China Sea as China aggressively asserts its claim to disputed islands, reefs, and the U.S. pushes back. China keeps raising the stakes, testing, prodding, building out those reefs, unsettling its neighbors and the U.S., and asserting its power on the global stage. This hour on Point, dredging and claims in the South China Sea and new strains in the U.S.-China relationship. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you been following the face-off in the South China Sea? Should America just back away or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. You've no doubt seen the photographs from the air of all those Chinese dredging boats turning reefs into islands. Last month, a U.S. surveillance plane flew over some of that activity. Here's a little bit of a recently declassified bit of audio. And the Chinese Navy, you will hear loud and clear, warning the American military plane to leave the area.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately.
Leave immediately. This is Chinese Navy. On Saturday, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter was in Singapore for the Shangri-La Dialogue Summit. It was critical of China's territorial claims in the South China Sea.
The United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, as U.S. forces do all over the world. America, alongside its allies and partners in the regional architecture, will not be deterred from exercising these rights, the rights of all nations. After all, turning an underwater rock into an airfield simply does not afford the rights of sovereignty or permit restrictions on international air or maritime transit.
No rights of sovereignty here, says the American Secretary of Defense. And a Chinese senior colonel, also at the Singapore dialogue, had this to say.
Your criticism is groundless and not constructive.
Groundless and not constructive. Simon Denyer is China Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He joins us right now from Beijing. Simon, thank you very much for being with us. Is this high tension of May behind us now? Has this been settled?
It certainly hasn't been settled, Tom. Hi, good to talk to you. It's a very difficult situation. It's clear that neither side wants this to escalate into conflict or outright confrontation. But by the same token, both America and China are determined to stick to their positions. And at the moment, those positions appear to be contradictory.
Remind us of where these reefs, some of them now islands, are. This is way down in the South China Sea, hundreds and hundreds of miles from the nearest Chinese mainland, down south of most of Vietnam, south of most of the Philippines, not that far from Malaysia, Indonesia.
Right. I mean, they're scattered all over the South China Sea. China claims this huge swath of sea, which under something it calls the Nine Dash Line, which is sort of vague line that gives it says rights over all of the islands in this vast sea, including, as you said, islands and reefs which are much nearer the Philippines, which are much nearer Malaysia, which are much nearer a host of other countries than they are to the Chinese mainland. And China says that's a historical claim, but I don't think many people are convinced that it's certainly not convinced it's a cut-and-dried case.
The U.S. is saying that they've created something like 2,000 new acres of island down there by dredging up the seafloor. We've seen photographs of lots and lots of dredging ships very busily at work. Does that continue, Simon?
It's continuing, yes. I mean, just to put it in context, and Secretary of Defense Carter did mention this in the Shangri-La dialogue at the weekend, other countries did get in there first. Other countries in the region had been building up facilities on these islands and reefs, mostly in previous decades, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But China was the only one only major claimant that didn't have an airstrip. And so China felt like it had been left behind. What it's done is to go from being behind to being one step ahead. It's done land reclamation and building activity on a scale which is far bigger than the other claimants, and because of China's size, is seen as being far more threatening to peace in the South China Sea than anything the other claimants have done. So it's not, China's not the only one that's been doing this, but it has been doing it in a way which has got everybody spooked.
Remind us of the other nations that have territorial claims in these waters of the South China Sea, Simon.
So we've got the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, Taiwan. Indonesia has a claim which is with China, which is not quite sure who, you know, whether China contests that. Those are the main ones, yeah, that I can think of.
And the U.S. no claim here, but except to the freedom of navigation and air travel through international waters, through and over international waters, and a long-standing role, certainly since World War II, as the dominant blue water military power in the area.
Right. I mean, these are vital shipping waters. That's the first thing to say. So the whole world has an interest in making sure that trade in these waters, shipping trade, is not obstructed. The Chinese, of course, insist that they're not going to interfere with that. But, you know, the U.S. also has a very important role as a guarantor of Asian peace. It's an ally of the Philippines, which is a major player in this, but it also more generally sees itself as a player in Asia. The U.S. Navy has always seen a role in ensuring stability in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, so throughout these waters, and believes that it has the rights of navigation, of conducting military exercises, of surveillance, all kinds of activities in international waters, as these waters are, in fact, international waters. So, the U.S. has a lot of claims here in the sense of a lot of interests, let's say, that it has to defend. It has to defend its role as a guarantor of stability in Asia. It has to defend these waters as international waters. It has to defend the credibility of the U.S. Navy. And it has to reassure its allies that it's not going to let China just walk all over and throw its weight around.
Is there a path, a clear path, to standing down on this now? Can everybody just go back, you know, to Beijing and Washington and forget about the South China Sea? Or is this a...
No, I mean, mm-hmm. No, not to interrupt you, but yeah, no, there's no clear path, really, to standing down. China's determined to finish this land reclamation. And once it's finished reclaiming the land, it's going to finish building whatever it's building on these islands. And that includes airstrips, radar towers, and so on and so forth. Now, what we don't know is the end use that China's going to put to these installations. It says the main use is civilian search and rescue, maritime search and rescue. It's building a couple of lighthouses, that kind of thing. And nobody buys that. Everybody knows, and China even acknowledges they will have some military use, but most people assume they will have a primary military use to project China's military power. But there is still a question about how far China's going to push this. You know, is it really going to station well-stocked military bases on these islands? Is it going to use these islands to allow its coast guard to patrol much further from the Chinese mainland, to allow its coast guard vessels and its naval vessels to hassle and harass ships of other nations, of other Asian nations who claim these waters? So the building's one thing. And the building in itself is not a violation of international law. It's not a violation of international law to put some sand on some reefs. It might be a violation of good environmental practice, but it's not officially against the law. The question is, what's China going to do about this? And the fear is that China is going to use this to throw its weight around to stop other countries from exploring for hydrocarbons, from fishing in these waters, and ultimately, as you saw with that U.S. surveillance plane, that tape you just showed, mm-hmm. to also to harass military aircraft that might or vessels that might be of whatever nation that might be going through the area. So in that sense, there is a little window of wiggle room because China doesn't have to push everything to the limit. It doesn't have to be aggressive in how it behaves in the next few years. It may just build these things and then allow, at least for a period, allow things to calm down a little.
But we all heard that tape. Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately. Simon Denyer with The Washington Post in Beijing. Thank you very much for being with us, Simon.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
With us now from Washington is Mira Rapp-Hooper, Director of the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mira, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom.
How big a problem has emerged here?
This is a pretty significant problem. I think that Simon laid it out very well for us just a few moments ago. And as he said, the United States has longstanding interests in the South China Sea. Clearly, China has longstanding claims in the South China Sea and also has a handful of new islands. And both are very committed to their positions on this.
Nobody wants to see great powers really start jostling too roughly here. And yet, do we have conflicting interests now that this island building response and jostling have made plain?
We certainly do have conflicting interests, but also, as you say, both the United States and China realize that a major confrontation between the two of them or between China and any other claimants would be disastrous for the region. When we think about the prospect for conflict in the South China Sea, I think what many of us are most concerned about these days is the potential for accidental or inadvertent escalation. And what I mean by that is the fact that China's recent island building and increased presence in the South China Sea may mean that its vessels or its aircraft clash with those of another claimant or with the United States. That's a real risk that we're thinking about right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this time about the U.S. and China jostling each other now in the South China Sea and on the world stage, two very big powers trying to figure out how to live together. It's tricky and lately not headed in the best of directions. Here's U.S. Navy Captain Mike Parker last month showing CNN live footage from the South China Seas of Chinese ships dredging up that sand to create islands.
This is a dredger actually pumping sand from under the water on top of an area they're trying to build up land. And we see this every day. So I think they work weekends when they're doing this because
24/7.
It happens. We see it all the time.
Pumping a lot of sand, looking to make some land there. U.S. and Chinese officials in Singapore just over the weekend looking at all this, talking about all this, trying to chill things down a little bit. After the Singapore meeting, U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter was in Vietnam. Vietnam's done some reef building of its own. Here's Ash Carter talking to the BBC yesterday.
We're not looking to militarize the situation or to escalate the situation. We will continue to do what we have traditionally done out here for seven decades now since World War II ended. We play a pivotal role, and that's a system that has worked well for 70 years. We got to keep a good thing going out here.
Let's keep a good thing going. Trying to speak to Beijing there. Look, let's not rock the boat too much. It's worked for you. It's worked for us. But China may have different ideas. On the other hand, they wanted to calm things down in Singapore. Here was Chinese Admiral Sun Jianguo speaking after Ash Carter. This is from a prepared script at the Shangri-La Dialogue on Saturday, interpreted by CNN.
Regarding the issue of air defense zone in the South China Sea, it will depend on whether our security in the air and maritime will be threatened and to what extent, and comprehensive factors will be taken into consideration. The situation in the South China Sea has been on the whole peaceful and stable. There is no reason for people to play up this issue in the South China Sea.
So, here we are, planes in the sky and ships in the sea and two great big powers, one rising, one the status quo power, looking at each other. Mira Rapp-Hooper is with us from the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies from Washington. From Washington as well, Patrick Cronin, Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. He's co-author of Cooperation from Strength, the United States, China, and the South China Sea. Patrick Cronin, welcome to the show.
Tom, it's good to be here.
South China Sea used to be my backyard. Used to look out at it from home in Hong Kong for years. It's a big swath of ocean. China's been thinking about it, writing about it, published a white paper recently that you called, Patrick, a blueprint for achieving slow-motion regional hegemony. Is that China's plan, and how does that square with America's international role?
China has great expectations. It has a dream. It wants to be rejuvenated and claim historical rights. So it's been consistent that the South China Sea has been its territory for a long time, but it really hasn't had the capability to do anything about it. Now it's doing something about it, and it's willing to alienate parts of the region, at least for short periods of time, while it takes two steps forward and one step back. These latest island building sort of projects in Fiery Cross Reef and Mischief Reef, for instance, are about 140 miles south of the 12-degree latitude north latitude line where in the past China has been happy to hold territory and sovereignty. So this is pushing a de facto claim over this so-called cow's tongue or nine-dash line claim over most of the South China Sea. And I think that's slow-motion hegemony.
Slow-motion hegemony, how does that phrase strike you, Mira? Is that what's happening here? Is this China's Monroe Doctrine being made manifest in its backyard?
I certainly think that Patrick is right, that it seems like China is attempting to incrementally advance its aims and make its nine-dash line or U-shaped line claim a reality by its development of these islands in the South China Sea.
So you've got the United States under President Obama saying it wants to pivot to Asia, to the Pacific, and of course a long, long time Pacific role and many allies there. Is this Chinese agenda consistent, compatible with the American role as Washington understands it, Mira?
Well, right now it would seem that it's not terribly compatible. If we were to hold our Chinese counterparts to their word that these islands were predominantly for civilian purposes, there could certainly be some type of understanding worked out between the United States and China and other states in the region, I would hope. But the fear right now is that China is militarizing these islands, not just building upon them. So not only are we seeing China building airstrips on these islands, but we know that it's constructing port facilities. These will allow it to land any type of aircraft it should like on the islands, dock major surface combatants. And just last week, there were reports out of new pieces of mobile artillery spotted on the islands. So the concern really is not just that China is building and wants a presence there, but that this presence could be used for military purposes and to coerce other claimants in the region. And that is not something the United States will stand by.
These two nations have an enormous interest in one another economically and well beyond. How significant a risk is there of an accidental military clash?
Well, I think the risk was really well captured by the audio clip that you played from the P-8 overflight that took place recently that was declassified by the Pentagon. You heard the Chinese military officials say that this is the Chinese military and you are approaching a military alert zone. But if you had listened a little further, you would have heard that the U.S. pilot responded that he was in international airspace and was flying in accordance with international law. And that really gets to the heart of the matter of what's at issue here. Because China has not clarified its claims in the South China Sea and has not made clear what it intends to do with these islands, the United States and other states in the region do not understand either what it claims in terms of sovereign territory or what it plans to claim in terms of maritime entitlements and airspace around these islands. The United States, for its part, continues to see the airspace over these islands as international airspace, the waters as international waters, because these islands were essentially built out of nothing. So the real danger when it comes to an accidental clash is that by not understanding China's intentions, by not understanding what China thinks it's claiming in this area, there could be an accident between vessels or aircraft.
Patrick Cronin, that's a scary thought. Why is all this happening now? What are the sort of converging arcs or national paths here that have led us to this moment?
Sure, Tom. First of all, it's important to emphasize there's a reason why China is the largest trading partner of all the countries in the region, and the fact that China and the United States have great convergent interests, not just on trade, but also on climate change, on a lot of global issues, on terrorism. And yet, at the same time, there's an intensification of competition in these semi-enclosed seas in the South and East China Seas in particular. The Japanese Coast Guard, for instance, has the same kind of light boards that light up when the Chinese approach the Senkaku Islands, as the Japanese call the islands
they
administer.
East China Sea. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so there's an intensification, especially over the last 6 or 7 years. China seized an opportunity. The United States was down after the 2008 recession. China was rising. China wanted to stake out its newfound power to show that it was a rising great power and that this was a historical right and a very defensive right. China is not spoiling for a fight. It does not want conflict, but it is seeking a classical Chinese positioning strategy of incrementally increasing their influence to secure their neighborhood around the periphery of China.
But, Miro, what does that mean for the United States, which has traded with China as part of a vision of a global economy, which has been a champion for decades and decades, more than that, of international waters and freedom of navigation? Can China have that backyard as it would like to have it, and the United States have its vision of a global economy, global freedoms?
Well, I think exactly as Patrick noted, it is important to recognize that there are many areas of key cooperation between the United States and China. These certainly include the economic relationship, but they also include security issues like North Korea and the Iran nuclear question. But when it comes to China's rise, it's clear that if the United States wants to continue to stand by and reinforce its principles in the South China Sea, including international law, freedom of navigation, and the peaceful resolution of disputes, it's going to need to do so in a way that brings other states in the region along with it. It's clear that the United States does not have a unilateral claim in the South China Sea. This is not a bilateral dispute between the U.S. and China. So insofar as the United States is calibrating a strategy to push back against these incremental encroachments by China that Patrick has described, it needs to do so in a way that brings the Philippines, Vietnam, and other states in the region along with it.
I mean, those countries must be very nervous now. China is their number one trading partner of all of them now, as you point out. Not the United States, though. The United States is significant, but not as big as China. I mean, surely they don't want to be, those countries don't want to be pushed into a situation where they have to choose sides. And yet these steps on both sides must make that a bit difficult now, Patrick.
One of the points that the U.S. policymakers must keep in mind is that we can only move as far as Southeast Asia will allow us to move. That is, they do not want a confrontation directly with their major trading partner, but they want increased reassurance that we can provide a counterweight to keep the rules honest and fair so that the Chinese, we're not blocking their dreams, we're not blocking multipolarity. We're actually applauding that. We want to see China have the world's largest middle class by the end of this decade, which is what the current trend is. But we do want them to play by agreed-upon rules for the entire region, not just the ones that they make up in Beijing.
I've got a little tape here. This is from the Carter Center, and they put on a conference with the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences last month. It got a lot of attention. One of the speakers there was a friend of On Point, David Lampton, Mike Lampton, an old friend, professor, director of China Studies at Johns Hopkins. He gave the opening keynote address, and he talked there about a tipping point, and not in a good direction. Not rapidly, but in slow motion here, a kind of tipping point threatening in the U.S.-China relationship. Let's listen.
The tipping point is near. Our respective fears are nearer to outweighing our hopes than at any time since normalization. We're witnessing the erosion of some of the critical underlying supports for predominantly positive U.S.-China ties. Though the foundation is not crumbled, today, important components of the American policy elite increasingly are coming to see China as a threat to the primacy of the United States. In China, increasing factions of the elite and public see America as an impediment to China's achieving its rightful international role and that we are not helpful to their maintenance of domestic stability.
David, Mike Lampton at the Carter Center last month, the tipping point is near. He's a big thinker, a big longtime China watcher. Mira Rapp-Hooper, think with us about the interest of each country here, the primacy of the United States. And he means global primacy. He means real worldwide primacy under threat from China. And China, with its own vision of the future, are these two visions now compatible? And if not, how can they be tailored toward compatibility, Mira?
Well, Tom, I think that's what's being worked out right now and is going to have to be calibrated and recalibrated over the coming years. The key word, as you noted in that statement, was primacy. There is good reason to believe that the United States will remain the global leader economically, in terms of security, politically, for years and decades to come. But what we've seen change in the last several years is sort of China's acceptance of American primacy in Asia and its desire to incrementally assert its aims in the South China Sea and elsewhere, the East China Sea, for example, is a contestation to American primacy in Asia. And part of what we will need to do, the U.S. and China, to recalibrate this balance in the coming years is to think about how we can rebalance institutions that already exist to incorporate China into the international system and also allow China to take a leadership role on issues that are incredibly important to it.
Hard to have global primacy without primacy in Asia. And on the other hand, here's a big new power with claims of its own in its backyard. Alan in Diamond Point, New York, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Alan.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to state that I don't know too much about China, and like most of us Americans, but I did do a little research on Alternet, and it has a headline. In terms of the number of military bases we have 737 U.S. military bases globally, period.
Yes.
And so, we're complaining about a little bit of sand outside of China. Give them the airport. Give them what they want. We are so spread out around the world. It's incredible.
Alan, I really appreciate your call. Patrick Kernan, what's your response? We have 700-plus bases around the world. They want a little sand in the South China Sea. Let them have it.
Well, it's not our sand to give. This is the point. The U.S. is not determining sovereignty. The U.S. is trying to help prop up and preserve rules that we can all live by. So that sand in the South China Sea that the caller is referring to could be Vietnamese sand, Philippine sand, it could be Malaysian sand. And the question is, don't those countries also deserve to live by a fair set of rules? That's what we have to stand up for. That's what Ash Carter was talking about at Shangri-La Dialogue and in Vietnam. To make sure that we can build capacity and cooperation throughout this, including, as Mira has pointed out, engaging directly in a very cooperative fashion the Chinese to try to set rules, to avoid accidents, to avoid escalation, but also to make sure that they're cooperating on rules that we can, again, all agree on in a multilateral setting. And this is something that China's been resisting. They talk multilaterally, but they don't agree to any binding rules multilaterally.
What does that mean for the future, Mira? I mean, there are sounds coming out of Beijing saying, look, seem in real opposition to the American vision of an international presence, maybe even international law, the Chinese saying, look, this just get real. This is our turf, and you're not so welcome here.
Well, as Patrick mentioned, again, I think when it comes to questions like sovereignty in the South China Sea, this is not a bilateral U.S.-China disagreement. There are other claimants in the South China Sea who lay claim to the same areas that China is reclaiming right now. So this is not just for the U.S. to push back on, but rather a set of rules for the United States to help bolster. And when it comes to China's rise over the long term, as I already mentioned, this is going to be a sort of very nuanced stance as we try to figure out how to calibrate this balance and get it right. Part of that will mean encouraging China at every step to sort of accept the rules of the game as the United States and some of its partners see it, but part of it will also mean encouraging China to take a leadership role on issues and areas that are very important to it.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States and China jostling each other now in the South China Sea and on the world stage. Two very big powers trying to figure out how to live together. It's tricky and lately not headed in an ideal direction. maybe at a tipping point, some big China watchers are saying. And again, not in a good direction for that tipping. Maybe there's a third path here. Just keep talking. Just keep working it out. Here's a little bit from a press conference in late May. Daniel Russell, Assistant Secretary for East Asian Pacific Affairs at the State Department, saying the U.S. will maintain its presence in the South China Sea. Nobody in their right mind is going to try to stop that, saying here.
Nobody in their right mind is going to try to stop the U.S. Navy from operating. That would not be a good bet. But it's not enough that a U.S. military plane can overfly international waters, even if there is a challenge or a hail and query from the PLA. We believe that every country and all civilian actors also should have unfettered access to international waters and international airspace.
Challenge from the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, the U.S. not claiming territory there, of course, but claiming these are international waters. They should be free for navigation. Do they want to go military? No, said U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter here in Singapore.
We also oppose any further militarization of disputed features. We all know there's no military solution to the South China Sea disputes.
And that's where things stand. Mira Rapp-Hooper is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Patrick Cronin at the Center for New American Security. Bruce is calling from Charlestown, Rhode Island. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm intrigued that the administration has only responded to the Chinese island building when photographs began to appear on the front page of American newspapers. They sent an American reporter up in a highly classified military aircraft to overfly the region. It seems to me, I would hope at least naively, that our administration was aware island building has been going on for many months, if not years. It also seems to me that the opportunity to de-escalate the situation could best occur when the situation was just beginning, rather than being as highly evolved as it is now.
Bruce, let us pick it up right there, if I may. Mira, what about the sequence and timing of this? Presumably those photographs came out also because the U.S. government had them and wanted them out, I guess. And the timing of the overflight, the challenge, does it look as though Washington wanted to publicly challenge this now? Or Bruce suggests maybe their hand was forced.
I think it's important to note that U.S. diplomats, the current administration, has been talking to their counterparts in China for many, many months on these issues. U.S. government officials recognize that quiet diplomacy would always be the way to settle issues if it were at all possible to do it that way. And statements from the U.S. government officials on land reclamation, again, have been coming out for many months. This issue became much more public only in recent months because, as the caller observed, photographs did come out into the public domain, but those photographs were not necessarily released by the U.S. government. The project with which I work at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and other think tanks and research organizations have released photographs that they came into possession of. And many of us got those photographs through commercial satellite providers. So part of the reason the U.S. government has responded more energetically is because there has been more of a public dialogue around these issues, but that does not in any way indicate that they weren't paying very close and concerted attention to these issues in the months prior. That said, I should also note that China's activities themselves have really picked up steam in the last few months. So while U.S. government officials estimate that China has reclaimed a total of 2,000 acres of new land in approximately the last year, as many as 1,500 of those acres have come just in the last several months, so just in the year 2015. So another part of the reason why we're seeing increased attention to these issues recently is the fact that the pace and scope of China's building has really picked up steam.
Greg in Knoxville, Tennessee. Greg, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that since this seems to be an issue of international waters, which is something that all countries have pretty much signed on to, why would, and now that we're past the sort of backdoor diplomacy era, why would the United States not bring this issue to the United Nations to resolve?
Interesting question. Of course, we should note, Greg, that the United Nations is one who has not signed on to the United States, I should say, has not signed on to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which might come into play here. But Patrick Cronin, what about the UN as a forum for settling this? Is China interested in that? Is the U.S.?
Well, the United States needs to be increasingly interested and engaged in international law. We should have the Senate finally ratify the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. But as a matter of principle, U.S. administrations of both parties have for some time followed the letter of the law of UNCLOS, of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, whereas the Chinese have ratified it but don't seem to follow it or follow it very selectively. The Philippines have lodged an arbitration case over some critical issues, including exactly what is the basis for China's claim on the South China Sea, before an international arbitral panel, the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea. U.S. supports waiting for that verdict to come out in 2016, probably, to try to enforce that. Chinese island building is partly a way to essentially anticipate the outcome and make the facts on the ground favorable to China even before the ruling is made next year. So we are trying to hold up international law, but we need more international lawyers. We need to build up this capacity, because this is an area of contestation that's going to grow over time, but hopefully will not be a tipping point toward conflict. We can accommodate a rising China, but we don't have to accommodate bad behavior.
Facts on the ground, China playing a long game here. Patrick Cronin, Mira Rapp Hooper, please stand by in Washington. With us now from New York is Jerome Cohen. He's co-director of New York University's U.S.-Asia Law Institute. Has a new piece with Ira Belkin in the New York Times Online, headlined, Will China Close Its Doors? Been a friend to us for a long time, sat with us in Shanghai when we took the show there a couple of years back, looking at China. Jerome Cohen, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
There's a couple things I want to look at with you here, but first, just look at this meeting of two great powers now. The status quo, hegemon, is China, long called the United States, and the rising power. What does this South China Sea situation say about how they are sharing power and the path ahead?
What this situation calls to our attention is precisely what Patrick and Mira have been emphasizing. There are rules of the game. China has adhered to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The Philippines has brought a case very courageously against China to ask impartial experts on the law of the sea to decide whether there's any legal basis for China's actions. The other countries on the periphery of the South China Sea should follow suit. We have to have more attention to the institutions of international law. Otherwise, military conflict is increasingly likely. I like the example of India. India and Bangladesh have a dispute over the waters of the Bay of Bengal. After many, many decades of dispute, they went to arbitration. India essentially lost most of its claims to the Bay of Bengal that were disputed. But Prime Minister Modi took a very enlightened and surprising stand. He said it would have been better to win, but we didn't. But at least now we settled the issue and we can go on and cooperate with Bangladesh now that this problem is out of the way. This is the attitude we have to inculcate in all the players, including ourselves, that are involved in the South China Sea. We've got to bombard the headquarters, as they said during the Cultural Revolution, but this time not with missiles. We have to get Beijing to understand that the institutions of international law, including arbitration, including adjudication by the International Court of Justice, are there for a purpose. And we should all submit our claims to those institutions.
But maybe China, Jerome Cohen, just looks at that and says, well, these institutions are the fruit of long years. You know, the President Xi Jinping has talked about a century and more of, I forget the word he uses, ignominy or something like China's downtime.
Yeah,
why should they accept that? That, you know, they want to make new facts on the ground, a new reality, whereas a different kind of Chinese role would be exerted.
Oh, that's attractive, but it's totally inaccurate. China took part from day one in the negotiation of the Law of the Sea Convention. China had already entered the UN, the PRC had taken the Chinese seat, and the Chinese played an important role in the formulation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Are there steps in the South China Sea now consistent with the Law of the Sea, Professor Cohen?
I don't think they are.
So?
I want to hear impartial experts who know more than I do about this make a decision. I don't want it left to the Chinese military.
No, I completely agree. But, you know, we have factions within our own government within the last, 10, 15 years as we went to war in Iraq. People talked in the Bush administration about the reality-based community and, you know, people who had a vision that they would turn into a reality. Do you see factions now in China who just want...
Of course, mm-hmm. There are similar factions and disputes within China. And what we have to do with the help of the other players in the game, the countries involved, is to give a higher priority to the claims of international law. Otherwise, militarists are going to take over. This is a danger in China, not only with respect to its foreign policy, but it's become even more dictatorial in the last few years internally.
You have talked about, in your recent piece in the New York Times, Jerome Cohen, about China's leadership potentially caving in to its most radical elements. And you're pointing at something that is not out in the sea, but at home, China looking at foreign organizations, non-governmental organizations, and anybody active in China, and putting out a draft new law that would make them very vulnerable to being shut down. People thought for a long time China will integrate into the global system with more time and exposure. This new draft seems to push in a different direction.
Since Deng Xiaoping began the open-to-the-world policy in 1978-79, China has benefited enormously from international contacts and cooperation. Now we're seeing a new leadership that's taking a different attitude. It reminds me of the old play in New York called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. They are trying to stop many, many interactions, not just with the United States, but with the entire rest of the world in every field. This isn't something aimed merely at what we call non-governmental organizations. It's trying to restrict cooperation with every organization that isn't a government agency and that isn't a business. And that means universities, that means art museums, that means athletic contests, and that means, of course, conventional human rights organizations and others. This is going to be an enormous barrier to China's progress, as well as our attempts to understand what's taking place in that very important country.
Mira Rapuper, given that those factions may be active in China, given what we see in the South China Sea right now, what's your advice on how to keep this crucial relationship on track, stable, you know, not drifting towards some tipping point or into the hands of militarists?
Well, Tom, I think a crucial point to drive home is that both sides, the United States and China, need to aim wherever possible for transparency. The United States and China between themselves have put in place recently a couple of important military agreements that aim to provide transparency on one another's military activities. And the United States has increasingly been pushing to make facts known when it comes to issues in the South China Sea. So whether it's the video it released of the P-8 surveillance aircraft overflying the South China Sea, or U.S. government officials explaining how many acres of land China has reclaimed and how many acres of land other claimants have reclaimed, really making available data on what exactly is going on in the South China Sea and elsewhere adds more stability to this relationship.
But so far, the data is heightening tensions, not diminishing them.
I think the data, frankly, is an important step towards getting to a place where we can agree on some kind of mutual understanding. The data helps, as I mentioned before, bring along other claimants in the region, helps add to the United States' case, but also helps explain to Chinese counterparts why the United States is sticking by these principles. It makes it clear that this is not a unilateral U.S. position, not an attempt to pick a fight, but rather a series of serious concerns that are backed up by numbers and facts. And that is the basis on which we can have a more substantial conversation with our Chinese counterparts in the months to come.
Jerome Cohen, who's going to have to recalibrate here? The United States on its vision of global primacy, or China perhaps on its vision of regional hegemony, as Patrick Cronin calls it?
I think each side has to moderate its positions and try through a whole range of contacts to interact in more positive ways. They have to learn, and we have to learn to observe the rules of the game. I think reference to the U.S. questionable behavior with respect to some aspects of international law elsewhere in the world is a very important point to keep in mind. We can't just say, do as we say. We have to also do as we say. And it's very important to have credibility for international law. And the United States, as Patrick said, ought to be ratifying, acceding to the UNCLOS convention, because without that, we can't even bring an arbitration against China to decide whether they have any right to build on a reef and to say this is our territorial sea surrounding the reef, and maybe they'll even say this is part of our exclusive economic zone. We have to be able to lead the way in international law practice as well as preaching. And I think the Chinese leadership has to be reached by all the elite and the intellectuals around China to tell them they've got to participate more.
Jerome Cohen at NYU, great to have you with us for a few minutes today. Thank you so much for being here. Patrick Cronin at the Center for New American Security in Washington and Mira Rapp Hooper at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Our thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.